We are picking up at verse 11 of chapter 4. Verse 11 of chapter 4, that's page 1469 in the Pew Bibles. And we are making our way through, I guess I'm going to say this every single week, but an incredibly important passage in Romans. I mentioned that this section here in many ways is kind of the hinge of everything. But it also gives us a really good opportunity, particularly tonight. There'll be a lot of talk of grace tonight. We're also going to need some grace in terms of how long it's going to take us to get through some next few verses. Because so much is hinged on this, just not even in terms of Romans, but in terms of Christian history and understanding of how everything works. So particularly verse 11 is going to take us a little bit to get through. But the rest of it too, a little bit, just to make sure we've gotten all the glory out of, or at least a modicum of glory out of these verses that's there. So let's pick up at verse 11. And he, this is of course Abraham, and he received the sign of circumcision, a seal of the righteousness of the faith, which he had yet being uncircumcised, that he might be the father of all them that believe, though they be not circumcised, that righteousness might be imputed unto them also. Okay, remember, imputed has this meaning in chapter 4 of counted or reckoned, counted to, right? That's the kind of a big idea he is pulsating through this. Okay, so, and he received the sign of circumcision. So it's interesting, the grammar of this particular verse is actually quite helpful. The circumcision here is kind of a fancy term, is a what they call a genitive of identity, right? It's telling us something about in apposition, what kind of comes before. And so what that kind of reveals to us helpfully is that circumcision here is seen, is particularly as a seal or a sign, right? And what we mean by that is that it's something that signifies and points us back towards something else. In this case, what does it signify? Well, we have to kind of know Genesis 17, right? We have to know what's happening there because, interestingly, Paul kind of assumes we're in that world. So, of course, in Genesis 17, it's a sign of the covenant, right? The covenant that God has made with Abraham. And, of course, Abraham and his seed, right? That's coming. So this seal is an outward and visible authentication, a kind of a guarantee of what it is symbolizing, right? So it's this physical thing that guarantees what God has said, the promise that's been made. It's almost certain that this way of talking about circumcision as a seal was around before Paul. And Paul is utilizing it here, as we've seen before. Paul is going to jump right into the arguments that are going to be made by the rabbis. He's fine getting rabbinical arguments. The point he's going to consistently make again and again, though, is that the scripture is on his side. All of scripture testifies to Christ. All of it is showing that it's faith that saves. And that's one of the things he's going to work through here. That it ultimately... He starts off by saying that this circumcision is a seal, not the thing that actually is the saving element. It isn't the justifying thing, it's the seal of being justified. But what might happen when we're thinking about it and is, okay, so it must not really be very meaningful. It's just sort of a thing, right? Just a seal, who cares, right? But that's not the case at all, right? One of the things he's making sure we realize in this verse is that it had an incredibly important purpose. It seals that righteousness which comes by faith. And without the seal, for example, one would think of a classic one, is of a document you think of in ancient times. You had wax seals on those documents, and you would use the ring to make the imprint on the document. And if that was broken, it was not valid. Or if it didn't have the seal on it, it was also not valid. It had to have that seal on it to be a valid communication of what was happening. That's a rough analogy in some ways what we mean here by the seal of the thing that makes it real, right? Particularly real for us in a physical, substantial way. It's also really interesting here that Paul's point again and again is that Abraham already has righteousness. Right? The righteousness has come to him through faith. This thing is not what makes him righteous. Otherwise, the Jews could boast about it and say, this is what actually is the thing that makes us righteous rather than faith, and you have to be circumcised or you can't be righteous. Paul's point here is that obviously can't be true given what's happened to Abraham. And he's going to continue to work this out. But that first thing is that's an important thing to recognize. We also learn something here and why this verse is so important, because it establishes a general idea of how sacraments work, right? When we think of sacramental theology, we should already start to be thinking about how Paul's talking about circumcision here, as an instrument through which grace is bestowed, a seal on a righteousness bestowed by the Holy Spirit, right? This is the very language, sign and seal of sacramental theology, right? According to Paul, this seal is a way in which righteousness is kind of impressed into our hearts. Right? It's made real and substantial. Because although the sacraments don't have power in and of themselves, right? It isn't as if they're magic talismans or something. Think of water, think of bread and wine. These things in and of themselves aren't the means by which they're not deity themselves, right? It's a sign and seal of that thing coming to us. It's a which is made in that moment a reality. We don't want to discount what's happening in that process and what's happening in baptism and the Lord's Supper or what's happening in circumcision. There's a real change from one space to the next, right? It's in some ways, perhaps if we think about it, the physicality of circumcision is a helpful way of us thinking about how much of a change we're talking about here in terms of that, in terms of what's happening. Within there. But again, the circumcision is a signifier of the hidden work of the Holy Spirit, right? It isn't the knife, or it isn't the bread or the wine, it isn't the water that has power. It's God who has power. It's the Holy Spirit who has power. And that's the means by which these things are used as instruments to reveal that power and also to really bestow God's unmerited favor upon us, his grace. Now, of course, even there, we have to recognize that the point Paul is making is none of this is possible without faith. Right? And this is something we also mention in our sacramental theology a lot, that baptism, the Lord's Supper, none of these things are effective outside of faith. Right? It isn't sort of a mechanism that sort of magically changes you into something else or does something to you. Faith is necessary. And a really helpful analogy we actually have from our readings in Exodus recently. For example, when we think of, the waters of the Red Sea are parted and the people of Israel go through, all the families, old, young, everyone comes through as a part of the covenant. They're saved from water, right? Same water, Pharaoh and his soldiers go through, and what happens? They're destroyed, right? This is an image of baptism, of course, right? Same for Noah's Ark. Noah's family is saved from the water. The heathen are not. They're destroyed by the water. Same water, right? We have to recognize that the sacraments approach without faith are judgment and condemnation. That's why we talk about, I have that exhortation where I say, hey, if you're unfaithful to God, don't come and receive communion, because that'll kill you. That's what Paul says to the Corinthians. Don't do it. Well, why? Well, because this thing that is the medicine of immortality to the faithful is a horrible plague to those who are unfaithful. The same as Pharaoh's troops going through the Red Sea. Without faith, what happens? They're destroyed, right? Same water. That's why sometimes it can be kind of funny about the symbolism of baptism. When we talk about, like, you know, whether a person has to go down full immersion, whether they have to be down there for 30 seconds, or whether it counts, right? All those kinds of, like, how much do you have to get wet, right? Like, for it all to count. That can kind of miss the point, right? Because it's the dry person who's saved from the water, who in all of these analogies, who's the one who's with God, right? So it's not a matter of the water in that sense being all over you. It's a matter of all this is a symbol of being saved from the water, right? That's why the imagery Paul is being buried with Christ in baptism, like you're saved from that, right? From the grave, like all these things you're getting out of that thing, not like getting into it. So that's important for us when we kind of wrestle with all this symbolism, that we do take it as symbolism. Like, what is it? What is its purpose? What is it symbolizing to us? And then make sure we understand that, you know, what's the best way for us to express that symbolism, and what are the areas in which we have some leeway on that, right? In terms of symbolizing that. And so our unbelief may block our benefit from the instruments of grace, from the sacrament. But that doesn't stop them from being true, right? That doesn't stop them from being real and true. And that's an important thing for us to remember when we think about this, too. It isn't as if a person who was circumcised wasn't circumcised. That was a thing that had actually happened. The question was that circumcision done in faith or not? And that was what was the determiner for who was going to be part of God's people, ultimately. Just like there are people who made it through the Red Sea, who then, the second they get over, what are they doing? They're rebelling. Almost immediately. Right? Matter of fact, the reading tonight, they get through all that and they sing a big song about, man, it's great that God killed all of Pharaoh's troops and saved us. And about 10 minutes later, like, man, I'm thirsty. I wish I had a drink or something. This is terrible. I'm just out here to die, I guess. Thanks, God. And like, I mean, what? We're like, three verses later, we're already complaining? And that's the whole thing, right? But again, you know, we don't want to, you know, that's also us, right? It's easy for us to, I mean, the reason that's in the Bible, as Paul says, is so that we would read it and go, really? I guess that's me too. Because I complain a lot about God and his timetable, and man, I wish I had this, I wish I had that, I wish all these things were going on. But I miss that all this is so real and true and shown to me all the time in things like baptism, the Lord's Supper, these miracles of grace that God provides for me, through which I'm united to him mystically and spiritually, and to just kind of ignore those things it's like ignoring a circumcision. As silly and insane as that is, right? That's kind of a fascinating thing to think about as we work our way through this. So, that he might be the father. That he might be the father of all them that believe, though they be not circumcised. So what's interesting is that Abraham's circumcision strengthens our faith in justification by grace alone. Right? It strengthens that. Because it was the seal of righteousness that comes by faith, so that the same righteousness might be credited to all believe. Because in a striking move, Paul is actually rearranging his opponent's arguments against them. Since the meaning and power of circumcision were already present in Abraham before he circumcised, right, that it can't be the circumcision that bestows it. It has to be something prior to that, and that's his faith. And most specifically, the unmerited grace of God. What did Abraham do to earn being called, right? What did he do to earn to being the patriarch of the chosen people? Nothing. He's a 75-year-old guy with no kids and no prospects preparing to die, right? And that's the guy who's called. on purpose, that's the guy who's called, right? And the guy who God promises to save the world through him, and he goes, okay. right? And even that's grace, right? It is even like we're supposed to go, like, man, Abraham's the best. Because then, you know, he's screwing up all the time too after all that over and over again. But again, what has Abraham done to earn that? No, it's all grace. And he responds to that grace in faith. So another question kind of comes to our minds. Well, if we're all the sons of Abraham, right, he's our father, why don't we circumcise people? Right? Well, because think about it, right? We're saying he had faith and then circumcision. Well, he's our father too. In faith, why are we not circumcising folks? What's interesting is Paul doesn't even bring that up. Here. Question we should probably ask is why? Because it seems to be kind of obvious that that's where he would go next if that was something that we should be doing, or that we are doing, right? If his whole concept of here is that a seal necessarily follows faith, well, what is the seal now, right? Do we just unseal? No, of course not, right? Because the answer is already implied in his argument about this. Since circumcision was used to seal God's grace, God has now instituted another sign to do it, right? Which we should know from Colossians is baptism, right? Baptism is the sign and seal of the righteousness that comes by faith. Okay. So it's interesting here. He doesn't even go into that talking about that because he assumes we already know that. Right? He assumes we already know that baptism is what's replaced circumcision as the seal, sign and seal of our faith. Because where baptism exists, circumcision no longer is necessary. Because think of, you know, baptism is many things, but one of the things it is a sign of the expansion of the kingdom, right? So instead of just eight-day-old boys being circumcised, you now have everyone being baptized, right? Women, Gentiles, the covenant has expanded because the kingdom has expanded, right? And of course, we would, you know, one of the sure signs of grace here is that this particular that baptism has expanded beyond the confines of what circumcision kind of entails, right? It's now this larger, bigger, globe-spanning, world-saving mark of citizenship in the covenant people, right? It's an incredible expansion of that. And so, you know, he doesn't waste time arguing about that because it's just assumed in the argument that baptism is now active and a seal. What's interesting is oftentimes people who see a lot of discontinuity between the Old Covenant and the New Covenant, I'm thinking particularly of this is obviously pretty extant in people who think children shouldn't be baptized. They tend to drive a real big wedge between circumcision and baptism. You kind of have to in this regard. But the problem is they like to use the language of seal to talk about baptism. Well, where is the place in which we get that? Here. What is Paul talking about? Circumcision. Right? So if there's no continuity between those two things, then you can't sort of steal an intellectual base and say, I'm going to talk about baptism using seal language, you know, signs and seals. Because that comes from here, right? It's a really interesting thing. So there has to be some continuity between them here, or that whole language of talking about this goes out the window. Now, that's not the only reason why I think this is the way to understand this, but it is interesting how people just... It's really difficult to be a Protestant and not use sign and seal language. The thing is, this is where it is, right? It's in a discussion about circumcision. Which is no problem once we recognize that circumcision is essentially an Old Testament sacrament. Right? Once you go, oh, that's what it is. It's a sign and seal of grace about bringing benefit. Okay, yeah, that makes perfect sense. And what is the New Testament sacrament? Well, the New Testament sacrament is baptism, right? Because it's expanded. So you have both a new covenant, but that new covenant is a fulfillment, not discontinuity between the old and new covenants. And that's really key for understanding how this all comes together. And also, it's just so implied in its arguments. It makes so much sense when you're transitioning from a practice one day to a new practice, right? What would that look like? What would that entail? You'd have a lot of carryover. You wouldn't just have complete discontinuity. And if that discontinuity was there, you'd have a lot more about you need to stop doing this or stop doing that, right? You'd have to really make that break clear, right? And that break is not made clear in that regard. And in fact, our connection to understanding how sacraments work is through circumcision. Particularly here, as we're thinking about how it affected Abraham. Because again, important for us, we're going to keep going on, that it isn't the circumcision that justified Abraham, right? But if we understand sacraments as being signs and seals of God's grace, an outward and visible sign of an inward and spiritual grace, then we have to recognize that all that flows, that the Old Testament is not our enemy in thinking about what sacraments are, right? That should be obvious, but it isn't always. It tends to be, oh, this is something entirely new that's happened, but that gives people you can then sort of make up whatever you want about it, as opposed to, is there any evidence for what this is that we have continuity from the Old Testament? Well, now we have a lot more data, a lot more we can think through about what this actually is. Okay, verse 12. And the father of circumcision, to them who are not of the circumcision only, but who also walk in the steps of that faith of our father Abraham, which he had being yet uncircumcised. Okay, so who is Paul talking about here? And the father of circumcision, to them who are not of the circumcision only, but who also walk in the steps of the faith of our father. So who is a person who's of the circumcision only? Who is that?
God?
No.
Jesus?
No. Don't guess. So, who is a person who's of the circumcision only? Well, what he has in mind here is someone who is a physical descendant of Abraham, who's relying on their circumcision as being essentially their ticket to heaven, right? Their ticket to being justified, right? Someone who says, I don't really need to do anything because I've got circumcision. I've got that. I'm in. But we should already start to see huge problems in that argument. Paul has been making the case for a while now that that's unacceptable. Because, of course, it isn't as if all the analogies we have for circumcision, and for that matter, we just talked about baptism, it isn't as if that was the... that everybody who went through that was necessarily justified or saved, right? But it just isn't the case. That's the case now, for example. There's not a case where every single person who's ever baptized in a church is part of the elect and going to heaven. That is not the case. That's true here. That's true at the Baptist church. That's true at the Lutheran church. That's just the way it is. There is real value in that. But it is not the same thing as saying this is a one-way ticket to heaven for indeed. So he's talking here, as I say, about these people who are boasting in their circumcision, but who aren't following the law, or in some sense think it unnecessary that they think, you know, you should generally follow the law, I suppose, but it isn't like that's the thing. That is necessary, and they don't even really need to believe, right? It's almost kind of a cultural connection. You've just sort of earned it by being part of the tribe, and so you're going to go to heaven. This is not a belief exclusive to first century Jews. This is a common thing one will find, places all the time of people who think they are owed salvation because of some affiliation they have or something like that. That's a very common thing. It's just not true. So the point he's making here is that boasting in the eternal sign while neglecting faith, belief, essentially means that you've disinherited yourself from salvation, right? The only way to obtain salvation is through faith, right? So you can be circumcised and have faith and be saved. Yep. You can have faith and be saved. Yep. And not be circumcised. Saved. Yep. But you can't be circumcised without faith and be saved. So what does that mean is the operating force within salvation? Faith. Right? Faith is the operating force within salvation. And that's really shows us how carefully he delineates between faith and sacraments, faith and circumcision, faith and we can even say faith and baptism. Like there is a line of delineation between those two things. They're not the same. Faith alone accomplishes everything for justification. Right? Faith alone. There's nothing else for justification that is necessary outside of faith. Now again, we always have to say, that does not say that good works will not necessarily flow from someone who is justified, right? You will grow in holiness. You will also do dumb and bad things and have to get up and clean yourself off and go back to war. But it's important for us to recognize that it is none of the good things that I do that justify me, just as it isn't circumcision that justifies me. Just as it is in baptism or the Lord's Supper that justifies me. Now, a justified person will be baptized and will see the Lord's Supper, right? I mean, you know your master's voice. You're going to the shepherd where he tells you to go, right? These are things that are going to happen, but none of those things are the things that actually justify me, right? And that is the argument Paul is making here. Because again, he's specifically making about circumcision. Because these people are saying, well, if you're not circumcised, then you aren't saved. And in fact, maybe just being circumcised is all you need to be saved. And they've missed out of the very way in which salvation comes, which is through belief, which is through faith. Right? And again, this is a very common problem. This is not again, limited to the first century Jews. This also breaks down the idea that there's like a huge difference between the sacraments of the Old Testament and the sacraments of the New. So that sort of one thing you'll hear from, for example, our Roman counterparts is that the Old Testament sacraments had no power to justify, but the New Testament ones do. Right? And that's part of their new and more powerful. But again, Paul isn't attacking ceremony here. He isn't attacking even ritual. He's attacking, as we'll see as we move down, the law itself as being the means by which salvation is made. So I think it's fair for us to say that just as baptism doesn't justify, circumcision doesn't justify, all of Paul's argument is that faith is what justifies. And you can see why that was such an important aspect of the Reformation and continues to this day to be such an important thing. Right, it really is key for us to recognize that the only way that justification works and has for all of history is through faith, and we'll talk about why that's incredibly liberating as well and comforting. Matter of fact, let's jump into verse 13. For the promise that he should be the heir of the world was not to Abraham or to his seed through the law, but through the righteousness of faith. So this promise, Paul is really now, as I say, putting a line of demarcation between law and faith. Law and faith here, right? So we move from circumcision to now the law, right? We've moved from the Old Testament sacrament into the entire Torah, into the entire law, of the performance of the law over and against faith. And that distinction is incredibly crucial. That distinction is crucial. If faith does not draw anything from the law in order to justify, then we understand that faith looks to nothing but the mercy of God. Right? That's all it looks to. If the law is not the means by which God justifies us, then it's all mercy. And that's incredibly good news. Right? There's not a contrast between moral living and ceremonies or rituals. That's not what it is. It's a contrast between faith and righteousness and the law itself. That's huge. It's a huge thing to make that distinction. But again, Paul's argument is that this isn't a new thing he's inventing. It's all over the Old Testament. Right? For those who have eyes to see and ears to hear. But of course, it's also important that if justification rests solely on God's mercy rather than circumcision, rather than the law, then the Jews who are attempting to get in the way of the Gentiles and saying they can't be saved, they aren't saved by faith, are blocking the work of God. They're blocking the work of God. And that's how terrible that is. They essentially believe they're the ones who control how God can save, contrary to his word and contrary to evidence. There's a really interesting line that Paul uses here. He says that he should be the heir of the world. Heir of the world. That's really easy to run by. Well, what does that mean? Well, because it feels a little bit as if he's shifting gears on us. Because we're almost talking about eternal salvation, right? We're talking about justification and being saved. What does that have to do with the world? And that's a way a lot of people think about salvation. Sort of, you're saved, and you go to heaven, and then the world, who knows, who cares? It's all going to be a mess. And maybe you come back, maybe you don't. But the most thing is I want to be saved from the world, right? All the bad stuff that's going to happen on it when I'm gone, right? Or when I get taken out of it. But what's important here is central to Paul's understanding of salvation is the restoration of what Adam lost, right? The restoration of what Adam lost and what Jesus has gotten back. And that's not just for Jesus, it's for all. I mean, as in Hebrews 1:2, Christ is called the heir of all things in Hebrews at the very beginning, right? Christ is the heir of all things. Because through adoption to God's family, we also inherit all things, right? So the world is ours to inherit. It's an incredible thing to think to hear. Yes.
So he says heir, so we're saying like he's not heir to the throne.
Yes. Great question. Is God going to retire? No. But part of God's glory is that he has creatures who are bearers of his image and rule the universe in the way he does, right? In the fashion after him, right? Where we rule in justice and equity. We have dominion. All of these things are part of what it's human beings are designed for. Adam and Eve failed to do that, and of course we join them in failure if we sin. But the ultimate destiny of humanity is to rule the universe. Right? And we see it already in Jesus, right? Who's a human man who sits in the throne of heaven and rules. That is a sure sign of what our future is. Well, the future of God's people. The alternative is to continue to be at war with God. But instead of running around acting a fool, one gets to reign in hell, where it's not a very good place to reign. As some say, I'd rather be a doorkeeper in the house of God, right? A better position. So, this is true also of even like the land of Canaan promised to Abraham, right? It isn't just about the land, right? It's a symbol of the hope of the heavenly life and the abundant blessings of God that are coming, right? It's not just about that particular zip code, right? That this land is on. Just like Joshua's cleansing of that land isn't just about him
you know, kicking the Perizzites around a whole bunch and making sure the Jebusites really get it. No, right? This is showing us something about what's coming in the future, the destruction of all evil, right?
So all those things are built into that. What's fascinating about that adjusts the way we think about our status in the here and now as well, right? So it means that if we're the heirs of the world, right, then even, you know, whatever we have now, we have as a gift from God. And even if we're penniless, we can still recognize that all this is ours, right? All of this is a thing we will be given. It also changes the way that we think of, like, the ungodly. By contrast, everything they have, they're thieves of, right? You could be the richest man on the planet, and you're a thief. This isn't yours to have, right? And of course, eventually, it will be taken away from them, one way or the other. So that has to change the way we think about our whole status walking around. That's why Peter will look at can say to a slave, you can be a slave right now and be free. You don't become free by stabbing your slave master in the throat when he sleeps at night. That's not how you become free, because you're already free. Right? You're a free man. And he can say to the slave master, know who owns you. Know who owns you. Who's that? Jesus owns you. And act accordingly. Right? That's wild. That's wild stuff, right? To say. And you have to really believe in the life to come. But again, the only way you can say that is if you know Jesus is resurrected and Jesus has already shown you what life to come looks like. It isn't as if you have to believe on blind faith. It's Jesus has resurrected and shown us what humanity in his glory will appear, will be like in its fruition. So it's worth not losing that, not fighting against that, because that's eternity rather than whatever evil can throw at us in the here and now. Right? It changes dramatically. So being heir of the world changes the way you think of yourself, even if you're, you know, like the man in the iron mask, right? The royalty in jail, they have to cover up his face so no one can see his face because he's royalty. They don't want him to get out. But even in that whole time, you can never take away the fact that he was royal. And he knew that. And the musketeers break him out of prison and they take him to the throne, right? Because they couldn't take that away from him even in jail, right? You might be, your face might be covered up a little bit. Your glory might be subsumed in this sinful dark world, but there's no way it can be destroyed. It can be taken away. Because all of creation, right? The creation that Paul will tell us in 8, I hate jumping to 8 already, the 8, that in Romans 8 where he tells us that the creation is, we're just waiting for you to get on your throne, right? Just come on. It's waiting, right? It wants it too, because all the creation is designed for that as well. And it's obvious. You look out and everything's all screwed up and messed up and nothing really works right in terms of everything. Like, well, something's off. Yeah, it is off. And it'll be put right. And then it'll run like a Swiss watch. or better. Maybe a Japanese watch. I'm not sure. Knowing that and picking up on that whole through line, the status change in people who are part of the people of God is really key in understanding Paul's arguments here. There's it's really going to be key as we work our way through. But even now, we want to make sure we meditate on this reality that it's easy for us to say, "Oh yeah, God justified me. Great. What has He done for me lately?" Or what do I got tomorrow? I could use a little bit more grace right now. Can I get to the grace spigot and get out some more grace and feel better about myself? But what we have to recognize, we have to rest in the reality that we are changed and different people because of the work of God, right? And the lie is the pain, and that it's all temporary and suffering and all those things that we go through, and even
and lust and even all these things that are trying to destroy us and all these kind of ways. You see this all the time now because we know everything about everybody now. All these people are constantly self-destructing and they have like a lovely family and they were doing the most horrible thing you can possibly think of on the side and it blows up their whole lives, right? Like some thrown a grenade like, and the kids are all messed up and it's just this horrifying, destructive, evil, terrible thing. It is really worth recognizing that we don't have to run after those things that are killing us. You don't have to run after those things anymore. It isn't as if you're missing out by being faithful. And in fact, it is through faithfulness that we will inherit everything. And once holding on to that is so key, and so often people are missing out on that factor of it. And it's harder to do in our world. It's harder and harder because of how much we see and how much stimulus we get and how many things are thrown at us all the time and how sad we can get about everything and how much we want just to be happy about this moment or so. Whatever it takes to make me feel better about myself, I'll grab it right now. But that is such a temporary way of thinking and antithetical to the status change that has happened in us through the mercy of God. And what's important about that is what we'll talk about next time. What's glorious about that is, if this is through faith alone, grace alone, the mercy of God alone, if it's through those things alone, then it isn't me. It isn't my performance. It isn't how good a person I am that has made me part of this family. It's the same reason Abraham was made part of the family, the reason David was made, Jacob. All the ways in which God chose people for himself and said, you're mine, and I'm saving you from yourself, right? Saving you from yourself. So we'll continue on that as we work our way through. But the comfort of that should be, the comfort of that changed people's lives. When we think about the Reformation, and just Christianity in general, but the people who were willing to die for this were thousands because they knew that they would never give away that comfort that's in Paul's words here ever again. And a little bit of that in the church would be a really good thing, the willingness to die for this glory that we've been given. When I say die, I don't just mean big, dramatic, music-swelling deaths. I'm talking about the death to self, the sacrifice for others, all those things that make being a Christ follower real. All right. Any questions? Well, happy birthday, Clark, by the way. We'll convene next time and continue on.
Oh, well.